Okay. Okay, let me welcome you all here this morning and get started. Just rules of thumb, which to go with Sunstone. This is being taped. Albert just put the tape in. So if you have, at the end of the session, if you have questions, and I'm sure you will, and Neil and Becky will be glad to address your questions, just either come up and say your question into the microphone, or Neil and Becky will have to repeat the question. I love to buy the tapes. I always buy lots of them, and I take them home, and then you can never hear the questions. You hear the answers, but I'm always wondering what the question was. I'd like to welcome you here this morning. I'm Clay Chandler, and it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce Neil and Rebecca Chandler. Neil is my oldest brother, and Rebecca, my sister-in-law. They are from Cleveland, as you all know. They are the new editors of Dialogue, and the title of their talk is Bearing Your Sanctimony, Monologues on Dialogue. They've asked me not to do a long introduction, so I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to turn the time over to them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming this morning. We've entitled the talk, as Clay said, Bearing Your Sanctimony, Monologues on Dialogue. As newly appointed editors, and then again with you here this morning, we have undertaken to commit to perpetuate a dialogue. It's a dangerous undertaking. Or so we have been warned many times now. In my unabridged Webster's Dictionary, dialogue is listed first as talking together, conversation. That seems harmless enough, but the second definition is frankly a nest of thorns. Interchange and discussion of ideas, it says, especially when open and frank, as in seeking mutual understanding or harmony. Now, I will concede a certain idealism at work in that definition, yet it describes an activity more unnatural in humans almost than any unthinkable behavior. As Americans and Mormons, we believe in freedom of speech, but also in truth that prevails. We do not suffer fools or idiots or naysayers. And if we have listened to our mothers and teachers, we think you should say something positive and faith-affirming and nice, or not say anything at all. We are also quite frankly convinced that some things should not even be thought. It is not easy in discussion to endure someone enfranchised as we are to say what is right who does not. These are deeply held convictions, and convictions make dialogue hard.
Like most households, ours has rules governing dialogue. We started our confederation with lots of kids, so we needed lots of rules. In addition to the usual prescriptions against expletives profaning the sacred, expletives scatological, expletives insulting, we also banned the use of shut up. There's not one shy person in our family, our oldest daughter and middlest child once observed on her way home from kindergarten. And indeed, there isn't. The laws pretty much forbade that. We figured that if the family couldn't communicate, we should at least talk. No one was allowed, for example, to begin telling a story, think better of it, and then quit. We had enforced guidelines governing combative discourse, and we had to use these a lot. Talking has always been encouraged at the family table, if the speaker is between bites, of course. No talking with your mouth full is a rule most families institute, and sooner rather than later. But we found it necessary to legislate one other rule governing dialogue at mealtimes. No one is permitted to offer commentary about what anyone else is eating. This rule applies to the kinds of observations they used to make when they were young. Like, have you noticed that that peach sitting there in that bowl with all that juice around it looks exactly like an eyeball? They couldn't wonder out loud if the milk was fresh just as someone was about to take a swallow, and it's become particularly useful during those sanctimonious periods when they were experimenting with vegetarianism. And they were prone to remind the rest of us that the entree was dead cow, or to walk around cackling like a chicken, just to remind us that we were eating a living thing. What's likely to run afoul of the law now is speculative calorie and fat gram counts, predictions on the need for angioplasty, that sort of thing. The rule, and I commend it to you, is this. You don't have to like it. You don't have to eat it. Just don't talk about it. Because we're both teachers of language, we have directed a fair amount of energy toward inculcating the principles of articulate speech in our offspring. Even before the acquisition of language, our children learned something about issuing requests in an acceptable tone of voice. Whining was definitely out. A child learned early that whining got him nowhere. Once he did start talking, he had to learn not to shout or scream or engage in related activities such as spitting and biting. But he also had to learn not to interrupt when others were talking, especially if the others were adults. And as early in his life as was humanly possible, he was set on the road to master the intricacies of standard English grammar. We warned our children against splitting their infinitives and advised them against ending their sentences with prepositions. They were offered improving lectures on the correct use of the nominative pronoun, the need for the subjunctive mood, and the preferred past participle form of quite a number of verbs they seldom actually ever use. While we were worried that we might be overwhelming them with these grammatical structures, their implementation and rationale, our fears have recently been laid to rest. When our youngest daughter asked us just last week, "Does anal retentive require a hyphen?" we realized that we've been on the right track all along.
Not long ago, my wife and I and our two youngest children were at a restaurant. We were catching up. Our son, Quinn, had been away most of the summer in Wisconsin, where it seemed he had a girlfriend. This was news. And his mother, like any mother, was all inquiry. What was she like? Was she in school? Where was she from? How had he met her? And so on and on. He answered stingily, relishing her unbound curiosity and his own control over the information, until she asked about religion. Suddenly he bristled over his soup. "Why do you want to know that?" "I don't know," she lied. "I was just interested." "Yeah, right," he said. "You just want to know if she's Mormon, like if she's not Mormon, she doesn't count. She couldn't possibly be a good person if she wasn't a member of the Mormon Church." "I didn't say that." "You didn't have to. I know how you think." "It's not true," his mother protested, but he didn't believe her for a minute. We ate in silence until she turned to his youngest sister, Alexis, and changed the subject. "How's your schedule, dear?" "I got to get to bed. I got seminary in the morning." "And what are you guys studying?" I asked. "You know what we're studying, Dad, the Doctrine and Covenants." "I mean, specifically, what are you studying right now?" "Tomorrow we're just supposed to make a list." "A list?" "Qualities, like things you want in the person you marry." "Oh," her mother perked up. "Have you already decided what's going on your list?" "It's not my list," was the answer. "What do you mean?" her mother asked. "We're making it together." "You mean you're making one list for everyone?" Alexis nodded. "So? One list fits all? What's wrong with that?" "I don't know. It just seems maybe a little monolithic." Alexis turned on her mother. "It's not either. It's not some plot. You are just always trying to find something bad to say about the church." "What? I didn't say anything bad. I just said it seemed..." "You said monolithic, Mom. You think I don't know what that means?" Alexis excused herself to stomp off to the restroom. When she returned, we were eating in uneasy stillness again, a ceasefire, a demilitarized zone. But we are not naturally still people. After a while, talk erupted again, talk about pasta and Cajun chicken, the equivocal virtues of squash and about apple versus chocolate desserts. Before we finished our meal, we were laughing. Beck and I were with children we adore and who love and please us in return, whom we know like our palms, whom we could not wish anything but well. And all of us were talking together and laughing in conversation. We were not, however, engaged in an interchange and discussion of ideas. We're not altogether open and frank in service of understanding and harmony. And why not? Because even, or perhaps especially among people who matter to one another, dialogue is hard, is fraught with snares and complication, is a risky and dangerous undertaking.
Actually, I never said any of those things he just attributed to me, and I certainly didn't say them in that tone of voice. I never used the word monolithic, and conversation he just recounted actually occurred at two different times and in two separate places. But when you marry a writer, along with the marriage license, you have to be willing to grant a certain literary license. The point he makes with that story is, of course, very well taken, and that is, of course, the point. But that's also why I want to tell this story on myself, because if I don't, he will, and he'll make it sound even worse than it was, and the way it was is bad enough. But there's a title to this section. One time I got caught burying my sanctimony. The story goes back to when I started writing, and that was about the same time I learned how to wallpaper. My visiting teacher had dropped by and was dumbfounded to discover that mere mortals could put up wallpaper, that you didn't need to go to wallpaper school or be in a union or something. And I offered to help her solve a decorating problem in her kitchen. The problem actually was that one of her children had spilled grape juice on a wall, and she couldn't scrape it out or, you know, scrape it off or paint it out. Between us, we had five children under school age, so the work went slowly. But we were pleased with the results, and we were having fun, when suddenly something happened that would change my life. Somewhere between the plumb line and the steamroller, Vicki mentioned casually that she had published a couple of articles in the Ensign and one in the Primary Children's Friend. I nearly dropped the length of wallpaper I was holding. I had no idea that mere mortals could write articles for the Ensign. I think I thought you had to be called and set apart, or maybe that you had to be related to a general authority, which Vicki actually was, but she said that had nothing to do with it. You just wrote something and mailed it in, and a few weeks later, they would send you a nice letter thanking you, and they would send you a check. A check? I was beside myself. You could get paid to do this? Actual money? I couldn't wait to get home. I had four or five ideas knocking around in my mind that I had pretty much been looking to use in a sacrament meeting talk or maybe a Relief Society lesson, but now they would become published articles in the official church magazine. All my friends would see my name in print, and they would marvel. I wrote in very short order three articles and two short stories, exhausting every idea in my brain, and all but one of these submissions were, in fact, accepted for publication, and they did send money. The first check, as I recall, was for $23.85. I stood by my mailbox and screamed. One of my neighbors thought someone had died. But I was just excited to be breaking into print, helping to build the kingdom with my good advice on effective living. All the articles I wrote were actually pretty preachy. I was, after all, about 26. I had two tiny children, and I knew practically everything. One article was about getting started with home storage, which was a very big deal at the time. Another piece was on teaching young children the value of sacrament meeting, exhorting parents not only to teach reverence, but aimed at convincing them that children could be taught to enjoy and appreciate sacrament meeting. Pretty heady stuff it seems to me now, but at the time I had no hesitation packaging up my vast wisdom and offering it for the enlightenment and edification of others. I learned a few things from publishing those first articles. I learned that seeing your words in print can be a very mixed blessing, especially after some nameless, faceless editor you have never met or talked to makes certain changes. I read with horror the mangled version of my first masterpiece, as it later appeared in the Ensign, and I developed an intense dislike of editors. Editors evidently were ruthless, power-hungry people with blue pencils who made perfectly unnecessary changes in perfectly good copy just to show who was in charge. And I discovered that once an article has been typeset and several hundred thousand copies are in the mail, there's no going back. You just have to hope that none of your friends will see it and that no one will think you actually wrote those inane words that they now see before them in print. I also saw both of those articles plagiarized, one of them in a pretty surprising way, if you can tolerate a sidebar here. I'll segue from my personal humiliation for just a minute. Sometime after the sacrament meeting piece came out, the church published a little pamphlet called A Reverend People. And it contained two paragraphs that had been lifted verbatim from the article I had written and sold for $23.85 to the Ensign. There was no footnote, no attribution at all. In short, I got no credit for this. And the missive was signed by the then president of the church, Spencer W. Kimball. I first became aware of the pamphlet's existence when the bishop of our ward, trying for better sacrament meeting decorum and making a pretty big deal of it, read selections from the pulpit, prefacing his remarks with a preliminary, "And as the prophet of the Lord has counseled us." I wasn't listening really because my kids, they were older now and there were more of them, weren't behaving themselves. But then something caught my attention, something that sounded familiar. And about halfway through the quote, I gasped and slugged Neil. "Prophet of the Lord? I wrote that. Remember?" It's an unsettling experience. A little like finding out that your dad is Santa Claus. But I was telling a story on myself in which I come out looking not like a prophet's Peggy Noonan, but really bad. The last article I had submitted was even preachier than the rest. It was called "On Getting Off to Church on Time." And it was full of practical suggestions for Sunday morning organization and timely reminders that inattention to the published timetable of any meeting is unforgivably inconsiderate. Punctuality is a desirable quality for one to develop, but it's probably, in fact, a prerequisite for celestial glory. I had used the example of the angel sent to stay Abraham's hand when he was on the mountaintop with Isaac. What if the angel had been even a minute late? Consider that. The Ensign had bought this article, too, but unlike the pattern that had established itself with the previous submissions, months passed. And then years, and it never appeared. For a while, I wondered about it and kind of looked for it, but then the editorship of the church magazines changed hands, and I pretty much assumed it would never be used. It was really just as well. I had the $21. They paid something like 2 cents a word, and this article was shorter and more precisely to the point than anything else I had submitted. Besides, I reluctantly admitted to myself, my life had changed a little bit. I had, in the meantime, been divorced from a very punctual businessman in pinstripes, and I had remarried. Neil was a laid-back college professor in khakis and cords who seemed to assume that the 20 minutes his students were obliged to give a full PhD before declaring a class canceled at his university could pretty much be extended to any situation with a fixed starting time. By virtue of the marriage and subsequent to it, I had also acquired several more children. The 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 of us weren't exactly famous for getting anywhere on time, Sunday morning meetings not accepted. And then one day, possibly a day I might have least expected it, that article did appear, with no warning, over my previous married name in a section of the Ensign called Random Sampler. My subscription had actually lapsed, and I hadn't seen it. But someone in the ward had noticed that there was a Becky in the congregation with 2 sons whose last name was Cagle and started adding things up. There had been an actual tragedy in the ward that week. A medical student couple, disappointed that no children had come to bless their union, had with much joy and fanfare waited out the slow wheels of LDS social services and had managed to adopt a baby 6 or 7 months before. And this child had suddenly died, apparently of AIDS. Not of AIDS, of SIDS. There was a memorial service in the ward, and I had actually been running a little late to that, and I had been stopped by the police for speeding. But I had gotten away with a warning and out to the ward and into the building while the prelude music was still pulsating through a somber and unnaturally quiet congregation. Most parents recognized that it would be the epitome of gauche to bring a baby or a small child to this service, though there were exceptions. The chapel was full. I couldn't find Neil anywhere. It developed later that he had come in a separate car and had appeared even later than I had. I had to squeeze in with some friends. All kinds of people were there, lots of them non-members from her work and his medical school classes, family from out of town. All this very grim, as you might well imagine, and rightfully so, For all the talk of a brighter hereafter for this young couple and their eternal family, their here and now had been inexplicably and terribly violated by the death of the sweet and long-sought-after little boy. And I suppose some comic relief was helpful under the circumstances, and I suppose I should be grateful that I was the one to provide that for so many people. When the service was over and the tissue supply exhausted, we stood patiently in a very long line that snaked its way from the sanctuary through the foyer, down one hallway and across another to the Relief Society room, where the child lay in a tiny coffin flanked by his bereaved family. And that was when the stealth detective ensign reader passed her current issue with the offending article well marked, noting that the Becky Worthen Cagle at the bottom of the column was, in fact, our own Rebecca Chandler. And wasn't she a good example of what she was advocating here? 10 years, 2 husbands, 5 or 6 children after the fact, I was in no position to be sanctimonious about getting off to church on time, as the entire ward congregation well knew. There are, I learned, worse things than not getting credit for something you've written. There are worse things, in fact, than not being published at all.
The Trouble with Truth, Chapter 1. As an undergraduate German major, I took my first classes from a terribly proper, terribly pedantic, terribly Swiss professor who ran his classes with rigid military discipline. He lectured without discussion, buried us in reading and information, bellowed out loud at latecomers and the unprepared. He scared us to death, and I loved it all. Loved it with a masochist affection. Took endless notes, studied day and night for exams. But soon I had to dampen my vocal enthusiasm for this teacher, which older students and certain younger professors would greet with head shaking and a look of patronizing disdain. The man, they explained to me, was a dinosaur, an adherent of the old historical biographical school of criticism, which new critics considered as relevant to literature as alchemy to chemistry or phrenology to medical science. It was a waste of time and embarrassment. Unlike many, I continued to take his classes, but was wary now. And the pressure seemed to get to my teacher as well. As his graduate enrollment shrank, he changed his method in pedagogy, adopting a more fashionable approach. After one such course, he called me into his office and asked me what I thought of this new strategy. I told him what I would not have admitted to my fellow students. It was okay, I said, but I like the old ways better. So do I, he replied, confirming what was already evident in his class. His heart was not in this change. He looked forlorn in his fastidious suit and stiff white Swiss collar. He was an older bachelor, and teaching was his life, and we will not know how he would have weathered this difficulty. He died the following summer. It was a sudden and violent death, but in some way seems gentler than the erosion of his reputation and life's work taking place among colleagues and students at the university. I tell you this in part so that I can tell you that I am often amazed at how much of what I learned in those early classes has stayed with me. How often as a teacher I have quoted this man, recounted stories or background or information virtually scared into me by a conservative Swiss pedant. And how much of the genuine pleasure I get out of what I do now is rooted in that experience. But this does not mean that I became an adherent of the historical biographical method. The truth is that almost all of my teachers were or would have been his critics, and I was very careful thereafter to keep up on theory and to make sure my mentors were fashionable. I avoided the dinosaurs and cultivated the bright young Turks. I knew what was what and who was in. I stayed on top of things and I gave advice. But when I went off for 2 years at a German university, suddenly and terribly I found myself in an old predicament. My German professors knew about American New Criticism and thought it interesting, but also narrow and often irrelevant. This was the late 60s, and German scholars were exploring the social and political and philosophical dimensions of literature. Once again, I learned new approaches and truly relevant methods, that would make my labors respectable? Structuralism, literary sociology, reader response theory, and more. I worked hard to master the new questions, to acquire the right answers. And when, after 2 years, I then returned to finish graduate school in the United States, I reported with enthusiasm and not a little pride to my fellow students what I had been learning. They, however, listened with narrowing eyes and reported to the department that evidently I was a communist. And indeed, the first grade I got on a paper there was just such a grade as a communist might well expect to get at a real American university. Some approaches to literature were respectable, some were not. And you mustn't think this lesson was lost on me either. I quite quickly recovered what I had unlearned in Europe, returned to my former orthodoxy, and graduated from that institution with respectable grades. I am not complaining. I liked graduate school. My teachers were talented, sometimes wonderful, but it is with no small pleasure I tell you that if you went there today, you would discover that the latest Turks in charge and in power to be talented men and women who look back on my teachers with indulgent and patronizing smiles. They see those scholars who kept me so strictly current as quaint, their methods as fuddy-duddy and obsolescent. They, by contrast, bring new social, political, and philosophical perspectives to the study of literature and make very certain that their students do so as well. These are feminist scholars and deconstructionists, reader response theorists, and most especially the new historians who have put a contemporary face on that old dinosaur, the historical biographical method, and brought it back into the classroom with a vengeance. And oh, how I wish my disheartened Swiss professor were there to see it. In a little book I am fond of entitled Confessions of an American Scholar, Simon O'Toole writes the following. In a moment of modesty, the American scholar will concede that much of what is written is misguided and incomplete. He is as ready as the next person to take a long historical view and admit that the truths of today may be the follies of tomorrow. But his heart is not in this, for he knows that there is indeed truth to be arrived at. I myself, O'Toole admits, did a lot of scholarship in the name of truth, and it was all lies. The Trouble with Truth, Chapter 2. Of course, the great thing about religion, when you really have a religion, is that it puts the shifting sands of mere human reason behind you. That was made very clear to me by my home teacher. He's a convert to the church and worried, I think, about my prospects for salvation. He's sure I don't cherish my Mormonism as he does, and as I would if, like him, before coming to Mormonism, I had had to put up with other churches. The thing that really made him crazy, he explained, was the way they kept changing. Was nothing sacred? After all, God's truths don't evolve or adjust to times. They are the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He had chapter and verse on that. And that's why he'd become a Mormon. In Mormonism, you see, nothing changes. Oh, I said. And I am doubtless incorrigible, but I didn't bring up speaking in tongues or plural marriage or the law of consecration or certain ceremonial oaths in the temple or Adam God or any of a number of true and everlasting principles. I only mentioned the prohibition of the priesthood to black men. What? He said. I had to explain. He had joined the church in the 80s, and he had never heard of this. It wasn't in the scriptures. It certainly wasn't in the manuals. He blinked and looked at me strangely. They couldn't hold the priesthood? He seemed incredulous. I nodded confirmation. It was a moment before he spoke again. Well, that was obviously wrong, he said. And then he recovered. But the thing is, The gospel never changes. That's the beautiful thing. We were talking together in my living room in a conversation. We were not in a dialogue.
In 1979, I wrote to Nancy Dredge, who was then the editor of Exponent 2, with a proposal. What the Exponent needs is a Kirtland issue for the sesquicentennial, I suggested. I had discovered Exponent 2 actually in the pages of Dialogue, had been reading the women's issue, that pink women's issue that I read and reread and cherished, and found a notice that there was a group of women in Boston who had put out this issue of Dialogue and who are also going to have a quarterly publication from that time forward, and I became a charter subscriber. I think it was about 1971. I really loved that publication. It had expanded my sisterhood that I had enjoyed so much in Relief Society, but it had also offered a safe place for the exchange of ideas, for the open exchange of ideas, and it had also turned out to be an excellent venue for publication. My life was getting more complicated. My writing was much more circumspect, not very preachy, and much more honest. And I also discovered that the editors of the Exponent would call before they made any changes, and you could work with them. And so when you saw something in print, it was something you actually wrote. I was changing my opinion about editors due to having a view from the other side of the transom. I had been called as editor of the Ward newsletter, which is a challenging experience for anyone's testimony. And I had learned some things about what happens when people promise you articles that they don't give you, what happens when you set deadlines that people don't observe, what happens when people give you things and say, here, change it any way you want, that's just fine, do anything you want to it. And then you find them sulking in the ladies' room, saying things like, did she have to rip the heart and soul out of it? But for all of that, I really wanted to do this. I wanted to get the interesting people together in our area and write about what was really going on in Kirtland, and I thought it was an appropriate thing to do for the sesquicentennial, and I thought I could handle the problem. I tried to be proactive, and I had meetings with people so that we could discuss them ahead of time, but there were still some surprises, and Neil later wrote about them.
In 1980, my wife volunteered to edit a Kirtland edition of Exponent 2 in honor of the sesquicentennial of the church. And she set about with a will to mine the considerable knowledge of local sisters about history and folklore, architecture and crafts, about the Shakers and the Amish and the reorganized Mormons in the area, and especially about recent reinvigoration of the church and its program in Kirtland. He held meetings, passed out recent copies of the Exponent, and explained the enterprise, its commemorative, non-controversial purpose, publication, its sponsors. Almost everywhere she met enthusiastic ideas and promises of articles. Still, as deadlines approached, she found, as editors always find, that promises are slender reeds. She besieged the telephone, becoming cheerleader, counselor, tutor, and nag. She extended deadlines, dogged the mails, offered to type, to punctuate, to ghostwrite altogether. She achieved a response rate significantly lower than for cold calling and junk mail. She and the few close friends who'd helped propose the Kirtland issue had also to research and write most of it themselves. Hard work and hard lessons. But unlike the little red hen, they remained eager to share the quite stunning product with everyone, even those who hadn't found time or energy to help. They gave copies to local sisters and offered to set out free copies on the arts and crafts and talents displays at Stake Women's Conference. I'm sorry, they were told. There's just no space. Well, could they have just a minute on the program to announce the publication, brag about it, and tell how to get a free copy? I'm sorry, was the answer. There's just no time. But the conference display tables turned up kind of barren, and the conference agenda turned out kind of thin. In fact, the regional representative delayed the conference over half an hour, leaving more than 200 assembled women to practice hymns and grudging charity, while he squired their principal speaker around Kirtland historical sites. My wife found it a little difficult to remain circumspect. Why can't they give us a couple of minutes on the program, she complained, a couple of square feet on that table? Then a sister from our own ward, a stake relief society officer, turned and drew back the veil. "You shouldn't be surprised," she said matter-of-factly. "They told us all along that this publication of yours was not appropriate for faithful Latter-day Saint women." "Well," my wife countered, and like most telling rebuttals, this one was delivered too late and at home to an innocent audience. "They didn't tell me." And of course one had. No woman she'd encouraged, challenged, dickered, or brainstormed with had admitted that she did not intend to write, nor suggested why she might not want to. No official had warned or admonished. No one raised challenges, questions, objections, doubts. No one had ever been less than polite, encouraging, apologetic, and yes, even cordially deceitful. She had been beautifully submarined. And submarine is the canniest military art. Silent, subsurface, lethal.
The trouble with testimony. Not long ago, I found myself in a fast and testimony meeting presided over and conducted by the bishop of the ward, who also offered the opening remarks. In his testimony, he referred to the recent appearance of our prophet on the Larry King Live show. The telecast had been a great source of strength to the bishop because of something President Hinckley had said right at the end, almost by chance. "Have you ever doubted the truth of Mormonism?" the host had asked, and the reply, without hesitation, had been an unequivocal no. Never. He never had. Never once. He always knew beyond a shadow of a doubt. The bishop liked that, because it made him feel secure to have a prophet, seer, and revelator who didn't know what it was to harbor it up. But now that he thought about it, he too had always known. He just hadn't always realized that he knew. Now that he knew, he felt a lot better. And now that he knew, he realized that he had always known, and this made him feel better yet. He went on to refer to a general and undocumented prophecy that seemed to suggest the last days are immediately at hand, and that in the last days, there won't be much room for people in the middle. In fact, there just won't be any middle. People will either have to line right up with the prophet or simply be lost. The bishop concluded with a general catalog of blessings, which included especially his children, who were mostly grown and gone, but who had also been blessed with strong testimonies and who were all living the gospel. He humbly suggested that this happy outcome hadn't been due to anything he had ever done, that his children simply came to him that way. And he went on to praise his wife and his wife's family, who, had he not been placed with his own goodly parents, would have been the very next people he would have wanted to share his life with. How blessed he was to have such wonderful people, all of them filled with the desire to serve the Lord, to claim as his own, and to be sealed together through the holy bonds of matrimony for time and all eternity. The time remaining was remanded to the members of the ward for the bearing of their testimonies, provided they could be finished by 1:25. His comments had set a tone, one that he undoubtedly intended, and one that I'm sure many members of the ward found inspiring. Congregants filed to the front of the room to lean into the microphone and to partake of the tissues. The theme of absolute and unconditional certitude held throughout the meeting, even among the primary children who trotted up the aisle and the woman who offered her testimony in song. It could be fairly concluded from what was offered that virtually everyone in the room was of one mind. Everyone, I was forced to conclude, but me. Where did such a panoply leave an erstwhile doubter? I grew restless, and I began to wish that someone would put in a word of reassurance for anyone at all, who might have once entertained a doubt. I thought it would be helpful if someone would quote Paul on the subject of spiritual gifts, to remind folks that faith is, in fact, a gift, and that gifts are variously given. That to some it is given faith to believe, and to others, faith to believe on their words. It's okay to be unsure, because what really matters is how all these gifts of God work to benefit the entire community, that all may be edified. This isn't a competition. It's a congregation. And what better place to bring our doubts and our fears, as well as our triumphs and our unyielding certitude? I began to worry that someone in the congregation might not be feeling particularly blessed that day by having been born to the parents he had, that maybe somebody did not, in fact, have goodly parents, and that he might take that fact as a referendum on his personal righteousness, on his personal worthiness, or on how much God valued him. I worried about people in difficult marriages, or people perhaps whose marriages had not been sealed in the temple. I wondered about people whose children had not kept the faith, who had not recently risen up to call them blessed. How might they feel? Did their lives mean nothing now because they seem to be failing at that one thing for which no success in the world can ever compensate? I was afraid that someone in the congregation would take the part of the bishop's testimony about being on either one side or the other, about there not being any middle anymore, the suggestion that the ward might be better off without him, as an invitation to leave. And I didn't want anyone else to leave. We've had enough of that already. I thought it would be helpful if a former bishop of that ward, and I saw him sitting right there, if he would stand up and tell the congregation something he once told me, personally and off the record, that an enormous amount of the real work of the ward was then being done by people who, in his words, did not have testimonies. He had made it a priority during his tenure to see that those saints continued to feel comfortable enough about attending that we wouldn't lose them, wouldn't lose their families, their society, and all they had to contribute. I thought it might be reassuring for someone to remind the congregation that every functioning ward in the church has its true believers, its hopeful doubters, and its hangers-on. Some wards can count on a loyal opposition, on oxymormons. That's all fine, as long as we support each other. Some people move over time and in response to changing circumstances in their lives from category to category. Others have children who turn out to be in categories different from their own. That's okay, too, as long as the general direction is toward a community in Christ. When Christ issued the invitation, "Come unto me," it came without strings attached, and it included all of us, as in every one of us. And it seemed to me that it included all of us, every part of us, our doubts, our personal problems, our fears included. What matters is that we stay together and help each other through. I thought someone should say some of these things, but nobody did, and the testimonies did conclude promptly at 1:25.
The trouble with trouble. I want to close with a story I told here the last time I spoke at a D.C. Sunstone. I want to retell it because there is a second chapter to this story I didn't know about then. Several years ago at a stake leadership meeting, which I strangely wandered into, I listened to a counselor in the presidency assure those assembled that the recent excommunications of 6 troublemakers had nothing to do with persecuting intellectuals, as the newspapers had said. The presence in that very room of 3 or 4 PhDs, several holders of master's degrees, and a whole throng of college graduates, not one of whom was under threat of excommunication, was certainly evidence enough, surely, of that. In truth, the church had been enormously patient with and long-suffering with these 6 particular individuals, and repeatedly turned the other cheek. But they, in turn, had proved incorrigible and vicious, had attempted repeatedly, maliciously, to malign and destroy the church. Local leaders had had no choice, finally, but to act to defend it. That was the whole truth in the matter. Likely never even heard of them before that week, but he spoke confidently and candidly as someone enfranchised, someone in the know, and bore fervent, privileged testimony to the inspired wisdom and integrity of our leaders. We all have a right to inspiration, of course, being equal before God. But this counselor and his insight had just come from a long meeting with a general authority. And in the ranks of Zion, as the rank all know, some testimonies are more equal than others. I knew as I sat in that meeting that I was almost certainly the only person present who personally knew any of these 6. Almost certainly the only one who had read their work, heard them speak, pray, bear testimony. Surely the only one who had ever engaged any of the 6 in conversation. The only one, in other words, who knew firsthand that and why these elaborate institutional justifications were fabricated, misleading, false. I sat and I fumed. and I kept silent. Nothing I was going to say would change minds in that room. Nothing I could recount from experience or observation, fact or reason, would shake the certainty of this stake authority, rooted as it was in the even surer certainty of an even higher authority, and hence free altogether from the niggling requirements of evidence and corroboration. The whining poll test of an identified stake liberal, not to concede radical, would only solidify the wave of smugness breaking over the congregation. Spitting into a gale, especially a stodgy, orchestrated, institutional gale, was never profitable. Why bother? Instead, on the way home, I picked a fight with the bewildered brothers who'd driven me to the meeting. Later, as I explained my sense of futility to a friend, she cut through my evident need to explain with clear-eyed directness. "Oh," she said, "so you collaborated with your silence. The situation, of course, been complex. My assessment of the circumstances was not distorted or incorrect. The truth was, no one wanted to hear what I had to say. No one would have listened. The truth was, she was right. I had collaborated with my silence. Speaking out would not have reversed the tide in that room, but who knows whether or not it might have provoked some eddies of reflection. In fact, as I must tell you now, and this is the second chapter I told you about, sometime later my stake president invited me to his office where, to my surprise, he inquired about my feelings at that meeting. He heard me out, sincerely, I think, and expressed concern and even regret if there had been misrepresentation. Oh, our chat was not altogether reassuring. It had been prompted, he told me, by an article of mine he had read. In fact, as he described it, it was the very account you've been reading, you've been listening to here. And I was impressed, not only to have a reader, but because the essay, though presented once as a talk, had never, to my knowledge, been published. In fact, existed, as best I knew, still partly in typescript, partly in handwritten notes, and partly in marginal scribbles. Clearly, someone had gone to the trouble of transcribing my talk. I not only had the surprise reader, I had a surprise publisher and a surprise distributor as well. What impressed me most, however, was not the phantom publication, so much as the use this stake president had chosen to make of it. No threats, no reproach. While I heard her expressions of concern, and I came away from a long meeting thinking, if possible, that had I spoken out in that leadership meeting in the same tone he later took with me, I might well have had a hearing, a conversation. There might even have been something as supernatural as dialogue.
The last word. Neil and I came here today to commit dialogue, and we've tried to do that. And for the next 5 or so years, we will continue as editors of the publication that bears that name to continue dialogue, to provide a forum for a free exchange of ideas, to be open and frank, to seek mutual understanding and harmony. And this may well lie outside the realm of possibility, as Neil suggests, but then again, it might not. We are hoping and praying, frankly, there will be those among you who, as readers and subscribers, but also as writers and people burdened by conviction, will have the courage and the exceptional charity to attempt dialogue with us. Thank you very much. Five minutes, 10 for questions? Five. Any questions? Anybody at all? No questions. A question, yeah.
Why didn't you go over your testimony?
Have you ever stood up in a pulpit and said something like that? Have you? How was it received?
I think you're
Well, point is, he didn't speak up either when the time came, remember? And given the climate of our ward right now, I had every reason to believe it would not be well received. But I may have been wrong. Maybe I should have been more courageous, which is what we're both trying to suggest here. I'm happy that you are. Anyone else? Any questions about dialogue? Yes.
I have one comment and one question. I recently switched wards and had gone from being a gospel doctrine teacher in a singles ward to being a gospel doctrine teacher in the family ward about a month later. They were nice enough to give me a month off, and had been pleasantly surprised in dealing with some of the difficult issues in the Old Testament that members in the class feel very free to express opinions and offering contrary opinions and do so in a genuine spirit of sharing and dialogue. But my question really is, I have found that context to be fairly rare within the church, and I think in many ways the structure of our meetings lends itself so that you don't have that occurring, and in what ways can we foster that kind of a dialogue and exchange more within our church meetings?
You're lucky. There have been times in our experience, even in the ward we're in now, where it's been much more comfortable. I think wards undulate. Have you read C.S. Lewis? He talks about the law of undulations and how screw tape letters suggest that you can just use that whenever you're at a low ebb, you can really get people to bail. And it's been my experience that I've had some wonderful times when there's really been a lot of a free exchange. And right now, in our ward, it's particularly dreary. Do you want to respond to how to change that, or do we just suggest that this is the forum?
Well, I think a couple of kinds of things happen. There have been undulations in my life. Maybe you've had this experience where I have at times been the person who speaks up in a ward meeting and introduces an idea that's maybe different. And there's been times when I've just gotten tired and sort of given up on it. And there were long years where I was a teacher. And sometimes it's very hard to encourage those opposing ideas, those people who are going to disagree with you, just because. But I'm more concerned right now. I don't know if I can resolve it in the wards. I think sometimes the temper of the ward will change. And you're describing an ideal circumstance. I don't know how it works in our ward. Part of the problem is trying to stay awake. Well, I'm very concerned about it now as in dialogue. We do know of dialogue that there are people, many people, well-equipped, well-prepared to write for dialogue and to write for our publications who decline to do so because they feel it's an unwelcoming climate. That there are too many critics of the church or too many harsh opinions expressed in the journal. And that's often the case. And you have to understand that there are a great many opportunities for people with more conciliatory or more orthodox views to find publication. Those people who are unhappy or feel they turn to dialogue and they turn to Sunstone as well. They don't really have other places to express themselves. And so sometimes it seems, and it seems to many sometimes to readers, that we're lopsided. That's not an intention of the journal. And what we want to do is to encourage people from all points of view to engage in this thing, which is, I call it dialogue, but it's difficult. It's infuriating to talk with people you disagree with. It's much easier to go to a meeting, and maybe this is true of meetings, to talk to people who know that you're right, who pat you on the back afterwards. It's also sometimes infuriating to have the person who pats you on the back come in, you know, after the meeting when nobody can see and say, I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that. But on the other side, you know, in these kinds of forums, we have to make room and take seriously those people whose opinion is that we're destructive and doing a bad thing. We have to listen to them. That is a painful discussion.
Those kinds of discussions are very important, but they're very, very hard to conduct. And I think the perpetual aim of dialogue as a journal has been to discuss those very painful kinds of discussions. And every new set of editors, and you have to come to this job with a certain driven idealism, wants to do that. And we've been told there are two metaphors. One is the hunter-gatherer metaphor, where you go out and gather all this good stuff from all these perspectives to get this discussion going.
And drag it out. Sometimes dragging it out.
Dragging it out of people. And then when you get tired of hunting and gathering, then you go to the, what's the other one, metaphor?
Manna
from Himmel. There's just somebody send me a manuscript and that would be great. Great. But I think the reason it doesn't work, well, we always have critics for this one, is this is a difficult discussion. It's not an easy discussion to have. It's not easy interpersonally to discuss the things that matter, the things that divide us, the things that are hurting in a relationship, in a family. Those things are pushed readily to the borders. And, you know, not everything that happens in dialogue or in Sunstone, for that matter, is, you know, this kind of an issue. Sometimes it's just a long, boring article. And you know that. A scholarly article, and sometimes a happy daddy poem. That's it.
In my experience, it seems to me that we're getting a little more to the dialogue concept in the way that the church is emphasizing it in terms of helpful now. A great emphasis is being placed on the value and the real work of the Lord's Council, where people come together who have various responsibilities in the Lord, who honestly and openly discuss the identities and offer opinions that were not necessarily the orthodox view, but were something a little different. And to my surprise and pleasure, these things have been accepted, they've been discussed, they haven't been shelved as being ideas that couldn't be on the table for discussion. And I see that in the States that I'm in also, that we have that type of dialogue going on in the state operation. In fact, just recently in a state meeting, the state president said, you know, it occurred to us that maybe sometimes we come to talk about these things and we say, here's what we have decided, when we ought to be saying, here's what we are thinking about this, what is your response? And many of us said, that's a much better approach. So I think, to me, we're getting more open dialogue and discussion. And I think the leadership is being counseled from the top to open these councils and to hear the voice of the kind of junior leaders in the church around the world.
We should have had you. Excuse me, we should have had you at the microphone for that comment. This gentleman was reporting a very positive experience in his own ward and in his own state, especially with planning and councils being used and real dialogue happening as decisions are being made, and I'm sure we would all welcome more of that at any level. If it's long, come on up here. It's short. Okay. I don't think we've been given any counsel by our ecclesiastical leaders. I don't think they know about it. I don't think they know what dialogue is. I really don't. I would be surprised if, and I imagine at some point someone will tell them, but I haven't felt the need to go ask permission or to tell them what
she's
we're planning
been,
to do.
She's been counseled by a good friend to go ask permission.
Yeah, my visiting teacher told me I should go to the state president and ask if I can do this. But no, nothing so far. One advantage of having the journal in Ohio instead of in Salt Lake City is one, the perception is that it might have a little less consciousness of its presence, and that's part of, I think, the reason we were chosen. Not the only reason, but at least one of them. Any other comments? I think we are about out of time. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, that's it. Neil and Becky, I'm sure, will be available for a few minutes, but the next session will start in 10 minutes.
There is one thing I should say as you're leaving. We'll have a table back there, a dialogue table, and you have the opportunity to renew your subscriptions that you might have forgotten about, but you don't want to know. Get a new subscription if you don't have it yet.
Or a
gift subscription with the holidays coming up. There's wonderful opportunities coming up.